time is drawing near. Welcome to Bending the Arc. You are listening on listener-supported KKRN community radio coming out of Brown Mountain, California. My name is Sharon, and I am so happy to be with you today. And our guest today is Annalise Pierce, editor, community journalist, and founder of Shasta Scout. This show, Bending the Arc, is dedicated to being in conversation with individuals and organizations working for fair and equal justice in Shasta County, and it's one of the efforts of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. So with that, I will jump in and welcome Annalise. It's so good to have you here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So I always begin letting people introduce themselves and just tell us a little bit about your background and kind of what led you to a career in journalism.
Yeah, well, I always like to say I'm a non-traditional journalist, so I have not been to J school. My background really is in community development, and some of the most interesting experiences I had in community development were actually in rural East Africa, working with some tribal communities there that were living, you know, at or below the poverty level, and learning so much from their cultures. After I moved to the Reading area about 13 years ago, I had the opportunity to participate in the Shasta County grand jury, and did that for 2 years. And that really, you know, I'd been writing my whole life. I had used a lot of my writing to help fund some of the work we did in East Africa, and participated in many ways through my writing. But after working in the grand jury, I really felt like journalism was one of the keys to helping to unlock the untold stories of Shasta County and promote government accountability.
And what were you doing in East Africa?
My husband and I were running a high school for Ugandan nationals, really trying to raise up the next generation to run their own communities. It was exciting work. We loved it.
Oh, lovely. That's a whole nother show we'll have to do about that. We have actually quite a few people in our community who have been abroad under different, you know, auspices with different organizations. So We'll have to have you back.
Sounds good.
So Shasta Scout is the effort, the publication that you're probably most known for here in Shasta County. So can you tell us a little bit about how it came to be?
Yeah, so after leaving the Shasta County Grand Jury, I connected with Donnie Chamberlain at a news cafe and was able to write for her a little bit. And then about a year and a half ago, went through a boot camp with the Google News Innovations and really learned how to kind of set up and start my own news organization. That launched last year, about June, July of last year, 2021. We launched Shasta Scout, and Shasta Scout is nonprofit. We're totally independent. We're supported through grants and awards and audience donations. And we started really to just reveal more of the truth about Shasta County, help people to understand what's happening in their community.
Yeah, and I've heard you talk about the importance of that, of being funded by individuals and members. And could you say more about that?
Yeah, I think there's so much distrust for the media today, and that's easy to discount. But actually, you know, it's really well-founded. There are a lot of concerns about media, and there's been a lot of changes to how media is funded and who benefits from it, especially over the last 10 years. So we really wanted the community to feel they could trust us. And in order to do that, we wanted to be clear that we're not for profit. We wanted to be sure that we were not benefiting. And we wanted our community to be in a position to hold us accountable. So by being funded by, you know, local business sponsorships and local donations, really we're saying to the people, you know, you supervise us. You make sure that we're staying in line. And if we're messing things up, if we're making mistakes, you're the ones who are going to know it. And your funding is going to show us that. So it's a way of keeping ourselves accountable.
Yeah, and you know, in that word trust, I have notes to myself to ask you about that, you know, at a later point too. But it's a multi-pronged effort, I know. And in addition to how you're funded, what other ways does that desire for trust show up in your work? What else are you doing to create that trusting relationship?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting research happening right now with media startups about how we can increase trust in the news. There's a lot of ways we can do that. One way is by labeling our content accurately. So a lot of news kind of crosses the line between, you know, factual reporting and opinion writing. And at Shasta Scout, we're really, really cautious about that. So we do occasionally publish opinion pieces. But when we do, you'll always see opinion right before the headline. And, you know, we always label news as news, opinion as opinion, editorial columns, you know, we label everything. And that's because we want you from the very moment that you open that article to know what kind of article it is and not to be confused. Another way that we build trust is through our corrections process. So we've worked with an organization called Trusting News and with some of their researchers to work on our corrections process, make sure that we have a process of when we make mistakes, which we will. We're human. You know, the news is produced by people. And we make mistakes. So when we do, we have, you know, we've clearly outlined on our site how we'll correct those. And we, you know, we time, date, stamp every correction that we make. So it's really important to us that, you know, if we get things wrong, we're committed to fixing it. I think that's a lot more important than trying to say we never get things wrong, you know, which I think sometimes news media does. And then another thing we're doing to build trust is we're working on the language we use. So there's a lot of language in the media, even in news reporting, that can be very polarizing. And I think a great example of this, recently we wrote an article about a politician and we used the term far right. And, you know, we got some pushback from our audience saying, what does far right mean? And why did you use that term? And I think as we unpack that with our audience, you know, we have a very active, engaged Instagram audience, and we do a lot of conversing through emails, through social media. And our audience really said, you know, one particular person reached out to us and said, if you were giving me directions to go somewhere and use the term far right, that wouldn't mean anything to me. Like, how do I know? That's so not specific. And I think that was such great feedback. You know, I put that on my bulletin board to remember, you know, give directions that tell people something specific. Because when we use words that are vague, anyone can interpret them in any way. And that means it's not really news anymore. Now it's kind of morphing into opinion. So the more we can clean up our language, correct our language, make our language really specific and accurate, the more we can build trust across all kinds of audiences.
Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate the what you mentioned about opinion pieces. And I've written some opinion pieces, and it for me as an outsider coming in, it's very clearly guest editor or guest opinion, which I find in my sociology classes sometimes when students are looking for news, that distinction is harder to find. And
yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the most concerning things can be when we write about current news events through an opinion lens, because people then can walk away thinking that your opinion about those events is the facts. And it's really important that we trust our readers enough to say, here are the facts, and now we let you come up with your own opinions. You know, you shouldn't know who I want you to vote for. You should just know the facts about that candidate so you can decide who you want to vote for. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to really offer news as a service, you know, that's serving the public by providing them critical information.
Mm-hmm. The other piece in there that I've heard you talk about in different forums is the in-depth part of the type of in-depth journalism that you do. And certainly we're surrounded with breaking news. You know, my phone blows up every day with things that aren't really breaking. But, you know, everything's breaking. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that. What is your commitment there? And why should a reader be attentive to how news is produced in that way?
Yeah, so creating in-depth news is one of our focuses. You know, it's what we founded to do. And that's because stories are nuanced and they're complex. We want them to be simple, but they just really aren't. You know, I'm kind of reminded of a piece we just did a week or two ago about, you know, a distribution of anti-Semitic literature. And, you know, we had a strong source for that story. You know, everything was backing up well. But we still went and requested a bunch of documentation from law enforcement. You know, we talked to a lot of different people. we're just always looking to make sure that we're not repeating rumors, that the ways we write stories really drive the conversation deeper. And so it's not just this happened, but it's why did this happen? How did this happen? What should you know about the process? What's going right? What's going wrong? If all we're reporting is this is how the city council voted, it's got some value, but it's limited because all it does is provide you information after the fact. If we can say to you, the city council voted this way after looking at this kind of data, and other people looking at this kind of data did these things, and this is going to be the effect of this vote. If we can say all those things, you then have something you can really work with. And, you know, there's a local elected official who I spoke with this last week, and that person told me, I read Shasta Scout because I learn how to be a better government leader when I read your work. Mm. And that was one of the best compliments I've received, because that is what we want to do. We want to help leaders in government and community members to get better at the work of building community.
Mm. You know, in the past year, there have been brought to my attention, KIXC has had some things, and certainly in the classes I've teach, we've looked at some documentaries on, you know, the death of local news, essentially, right? Local news sources. And in those, they do speak to both what is happening and how did people vote, which can be harder to get when your news sources are taken over by larger areas, as well as that kind of in-depth, what does it mean, or what could it potentially mean? Here's some, you know, some richer information about that. How do you balance those efforts in a place where there is some local news? You know, there's the Record Searchlight, but we know that so many of the pieces there are coming from the AP.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is something we're still really working out. One of the challenges with providing in-depth news is that not every reader is prepared to access that in-depth mm-hmm. news. You know, we are attention short right now, and we're busy. And so sometimes people will say to us, oh, yeah, like, I love your work, but I don't, to be honest, I never make it through all those articles, you know, because they're long and there are a lot of links and things like that. So we are working on how can we provide sort of shorter summary type pieces or things that help people to kind of get the, you know, the gist of the story if they can't go in depth with it. But we still do think that providing that in-depth reporting is important. And it's mostly important because it's a check and balance on the systems that we depend on. You know, if nobody is watching government processes, it lowers the incentive to do a good job. And even if people are well-intentioned, it's hard running government, you know, and there are a lot of power dynamics at play. So by keeping an eye on all those power dynamics, by connecting those pieces, helping people understand how politicized things are, you know, all of that requires research and connecting the dots. And you would not believe how hard we work to simplify that down into, you know, 800 to 1500 words. Mm-hmm. Many times it's dozens of hours of research for an article. So, but we do think it matters. We think the in-depth component really does matter.
Mm. And I've noticed in your Instagram account that, and maybe it hasn't just been recently, but it's occurred to me recently that some of your posts are a breakdown of a story, some of the highlights of the story. Is that a direction that you're finding is fruitful as a way of summarizing, or are you thinking of additional formats for doing that?
Yeah, I do like the way we can do that on Instagram. You know, we create a series of story slides that, you know, break it down, and then the final one is a link to the full article. And my hope is that people may not have time at the moment they look to get to the full article, but they're still getting the gist, and they know that article is there. They can go back and access it. We're also hoping, you know, in the next 6 months or so to kind of start doing more like reels and TikToks and stuff like that, primarily for younger audiences, because there's a lot of kids in high school and young adults who really do care passionately about political issues. They care about justice, but a lot of times news isn't very accessible to them. It's boring, it's dry, you know, it's like homework. So we want as much as we can to kind of, again, provide that in-depth article as the access. You know, they can go there to find the facts, and they can see that it's well-researched. But through, you know, a 30-second or 60-second reel or TikTok, we can tell them much of the same truth, you know, in a consolidated form. We're also working on, you know, like a radio short kind of article summary. And also, I think, you know, there's a great nonprofit publication called Cal Matters that does statewide news, and they do summary boxes at the top of their stories. So that's one of our goals, is to start having those summary boxes so folks can just read the summary and then be like, oh, wow. And, you know, later on, if they need to, want to, they can come back and read the full article, and hopefully they can still get what they needed.
That's a really interesting model. I just read a Cal Matters about a much lengthier report, and it was very helpful.
Yeah.
So you mentioned justice, and I know you to be someone very interested in issues of justice. It's something that we've talked a lot about, and equity. I know that you've made a real effort in both the stories that you cover and who's writing the stories, and to reflect a range of voices. So this is a huge question, but to just begin to articulate that for you, the role of local news sources in pointing to those issues, particularly in an area like ours.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that has been true in American media really since the beginning is that media, like many other parts of society, has given power to certain kinds of voices, and it has provided a forum for certain kinds of voices. Historically in media, that's been white men. So as a woman media leader, I'm definitely an outlier. You know, I've helped start a mastermind group of other women media leaders, and really, you know, it was equity programs through Google News that helped me get started. You know, I was part of that quota of, we need more women because it's easier to find men who are interested in running startups. And I think about that all the time, because it is more challenging to be a woman in media for lots of reasons that we can talk about later on if you like. But justice really is foundational to the work we're doing in media, because media is all about sharing information, and what information matters depends on who you are. So if you are a person of privilege, if you are a person who has power in a community, the information you need is very different than if you are a person who's living in poverty. If you are a person who is, you know, straight and privileged because you are straight, because your culture and your community in Shasta County respects straight people, that is a different position with different needs for information than somebody who's gay. So in our community, we see that showing up a lot through Indigenous voices. That's been a huge focus for us at Shasta Scout, is elevating Native voices, seeking out, recruiting Native writers, and telling Native stories. Because we have a dense and critically important Indigenous community in Shasta County, but they have historically been ignored by the media here. And, you know, many people would say not just ignored, but really erased from our history. You know, just like our textbooks can either tell the full story or they can curate it out, you know, we do the same thing in the media. We get to decide who we ask for a comment. And so if we forget to ask all the players, or we forget to ask the ones who may be most affected, we're not really telling the true story. So justice is like interwoven into everything we do at Shasta Scout. Being equity-minded, it's really the role of the new wave of media. And it's like, I just can't overestimate how important it is to us.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that, as I have been engaged in equity work in different circles and facilitated those kind of conversations, time and again, I am brought face-to-face with the fact that there are many people who view concerns about equity or diversity or inclusion as a liberal concern, or that the fact that you're talking about that means that you have a liberal perspective. And so it has that veneer, and it's either discounted or embraced uncritically. So I'm wondering how you walk that line about those concerns, the importance of those concerns, and why it matters to people regardless of political ideology.
Yeah, I certainly know what you're talking about. You know, words like equity can be dog whistles. You know, they can be trigger words for people. I think people who read Justice Scout are often confused because, you know, we'll publish certain articles they think are, you know, liberal or progressive, and then we'll publish other things they think seem like really conservative. And, you know, our work isn't political. It's about people. And I think if we look at what concerns our community is facing, you know, we're facing a lack of water. So you could say we're doing environmental reporting because we're liberal, but no, we're doing environmental reporting because water is an environmental issue. We're facing, you know, critical danger from wildfires. Same thing. You know, does that relate to issues like global warming? Absolutely. But it's a safety issue. And, you know, we're looking at what policies and processes are contributing to wildfire conditions and how can we reduce them? So, you know, again, same kind of thing. Covering indigenous cultures, native cultures. Again, some people would say, oh, that's, you know, that's just because we, you know, we want to talk from different voices or something. But if you look at, you know, what science is now showing us, it's showing us that native voices, native perspectives have the answers to wildfires and lack of water and, you know, the extinction of keystone species that will affect all of us. So those things are, they're not just about equity. They're about telling the truth that we all need to hear. And whenever you silence a voice for too long, the conversation is always going to become imbalanced. You know, if you have a marriage with a husband and a wife, and one of them is not speaking very much or getting the opportunity, it's not just like a, you know, theoretical, this should be an equitable marriage. I mean, people just need to talk and understand each other. So by bringing all the voices to the table and bringing the issues to the table and kind of saying, I don't really care how we're seen, you know. I know we're going to be seen differently by all kinds of people. It's not my job to worry about our image or whether we're seen as a liberal publication or whatever. My job is to make sure all the voices are being heard as best we can and that we're really looking at what our community most needs information about, and that's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. That seems to circle back to how local news sources can be a resource for community.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think if you talk to a lot of legacy media owners or managers, they're very focused on clicks, you know, and numbers, and what kinds of articles get the most play and how long people stay reading an article. That's news as a product, you know, it's the market and who's buying and how much will they pay and what's it worth to them. And that's why, you know, we've really redefine news as a service, because when you're service oriented, you're customer focused. So you're not focused on your bottom line. You know, you're focused on the needs. You know, how can I serve your needs? And that really is our heart at Scout. You know, we're really focused on what's your need? Talk to us. Tell us how we can serve you. And we're not doing it nearly as well as we want to yet because we're tiny, tiny, tiny. But eventually we'll get there. And I think it could really revolutionize the community.
Mm. Who do you see as your customer?
We see all of our readers as our customer, and also those in our community who are, you know, what we call low news engaged. So they're people who have kind of given up on the news or maybe never utilized it in the first place, don't realize it has value. Just like with elections, you know, elections are one of our, the ability to vote is one of our central rights as Americans. It's pivotal to democracy, but a lot of people don't vote because they don't really know why it matters, or they don't care, or they've given up on it, right? And the news is kind of the same way. So our customers are the people who are already reading us, but they're also all the people that we know could benefit from reading. And we're always looking to say, how could we widen that audience? How could we look at all those 18 to 22 year olds who right now don't care about news and say, let's make news interesting again for them? Because those are people that will help us run this community, and we need them to know what's going on too.
And I think it's important to point out sort of the nature of online news sources. I am not an expert in this field, but you have people who read who do not subscribe or pay monthly, and you have people who pay as well. So that's a much wider than clients, say, or paying customers.
Yeah, and yeah, so a lot of publications, they have, you know, a subscription-based model. So you there's paywalls and you pay for the news. Our vision is that the news should be free for all, and that those of us who care deeply about it and have resources should help make it free for all. So that's what we're calling on our audience to do. We know most people can afford $5 a month donation, but maybe they don't want to yet, or maybe they can't, or maybe they're not quite ready to, whatever. Our news is always free for all. That's foundational to what we do, and we're not going to change that. And there are a lot of generous people who are beginning to make that possible, you know, and make that continue to grow by donating what they can, what they're willing to.
Mm. And we'll definitely put a link to Shasta Scout in the show notes and ways that people can support. And we'll have a general question about that at the end. If you're just joining us now, you're listening to KKRN, Community Supported Radio. This is Bending the Arc. And my name is Sharon Brizalera. I'm here in conversation with Annalise Pierce of Shasta Scout. So at the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, and I know you've interviewed members over time about the work, we're really focused on fair and equal justice with particular attention to the criminal legal system. And certainly there's so many arenas where one could be considered and do work for justice and equity, like many of the ones you mentioned before. Here in Shasta County or in Northern California, what do you see as the role of an organization like Shasta Scout, particularly when it comes to the criminal legal system and addressing some of the concerns or inequities that we might see?
Media accountability for law enforcement is really central to the work media needs to be doing. And that's because law enforcement professionals are high power individuals. You know, they have badges, they have weapons. And they have been given by our government a tremendous amount of power. You know, they can kill on sight. What that means is that we have to watch them closely and hold them to a high standard. Not that we nitpick them or criticize them, you know, needlessly, but that we're just aware that, you know, with that great amount of power comes a great amount of responsibility, and that media can help them more carefully handle that responsibility. The way that we can monitor law enforcement, you know, much of it has to do with looking at their documentation, their policies, their processes, and what they did on certain occasions, you know, how they did it. So a lot of our work around law enforcement is going to be looking at data to do with things like, you know, how many deaths in the jail are we having and what are the causes of those deaths? And when we look at the documents, you know, the autopsy reports and things like that, are they matching what the police have said to us? These are questions our community really cares deeply about. There are concerns in Shasta County because we do have unusually high rates of deaths at the hand of law enforcement. What we can't do is make an assumption. You know, we can't assume that because we have high rates, it means law enforcement is corrupt. Instead, we have to look at the nuances of that data. You know, we have to be willing to do the hard work to press in to really understand it, because it can mean a lot of things. You know, it can mean that policies are bad. It can mean that facilities are bad. You know, it can mean that there's low morale. There's many different components and probably multiple components to a lot of these things. But it can become really easy just to demonize, you know, an individual or a profession, you know, like law enforcement, instead of actually doing the hard work of helping them become better. And I really do think that, you know, most people get into fields like law enforcement, firefighting, you know, being an EMT because they care about people. Mm-hmm. And because they too have a bent for justice. And so, you know, I want to treat every law enforcement individual with honor and respect. My husband was career military. You know, I have respect for those kinds of offices. But at the same time, I'm also deeply, deeply aware that people who are at the mercy of law enforcement are often among the most marginalized our society has. You know, if you are incarcerated, you have almost no power at all. You have almost no voice at all. And if you die in jail, who's ever going to speak up for you? So that's my job as a journalist, is to be the voice of the voiceless and hold accountable those who might need to be held accountable. And that's what we're trying to do. It's a long game in Shasta County because document requests are time intensive and detailed, and they require a lot of follow-up. There's a lot of sunshine laws in California that help reveal data to the public through public documents, but those sunshine laws often shield law enforcement for various reasons. So we're always playing those complicated legal games, you know, trying to get better and better at getting the information we need. And I would say one thing I would love to see more of in Shasta County is seeing officials, especially law enforcement officials, really come to the table with media and be really proactive and quick to respond. You know, we're a real media organization, you know, we're credentialed by really good media watchdog types. And I think it's really important for people like the sheriff and the police chiefs to respond to our requests for comment and just to have that dialogue that allows the public to feel trust in them.
Mm-hmm. And how is it different forming that kind of relationship with law enforcement, say government officials? What are you learning about what it takes?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because this is, such a complicated game, really. Mm. And we are forging a new reputation for media in Shasta County. I think there are a lot of people who are okay, like going to the police, and the police say, you know, we're not really going to share about that. And then they just kind of repeat whatever the line is the police gave them. That's kind of historically how media has worked. You know, if you're on the crime beat, it's your job basically to talk about the bad things that people do in the community and then repeat whatever line the police gives you about that. We're forging a new path where we're saying we're going to expect a little more from law enforcement and from public officials. We're going to ask them hard questions, and we're going to trust that they're professionals and they can answer us. A lot of times it's not really well responded to. You know, I think it puts people on the spot and it can make them feel defensive. I don't want them to feel defensive. I don't want them to feel afraid of me or my questions, but I also want them to realize they can't discount those questions. So it's actually similar to some of the work we did in the grand jury. You know, when we would do interviews with people from all levels of government, we would interview, you know, really top people. And a lot of times they would kind of think they didn't really have to answer the questions fully, you know, but they really did need to. And that was part of our job, was to ask those questions. So I just try to remain focused that this is my job. My job is to ask you hard questions. It's to be polite, it's to be respectful, and it's to assume that you don't have anything to hide. So you're really willing to share with the public what you're doing as a public official, as a public servant. I keep going. I keep asking. Some people are responsive. Some people aren't. Some people I haven't talked to, you know, I've taken several years without getting a response from, and then suddenly they come back to the table with me. Mm. You know, I hope over time we're building trust that you might not like all our stories and you might not like our hard questions, but we do tell the truth. We're accurate. We're factual. We won't target you. We won't, you know, demonize you. We won't name call you. We would just simply tell the facts. And I hope that will help people over time to really build trust with us, even officials, you know, and people at top levels.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned data, the document requests and whatnot, and the SCJC and many other organizations often talk about how can we have more transparency in data within the parameters of the law, and where is data available, and having some information about being able to contextualize what does that mean so that we're interpreting correctly. To what extent do you find some of the data you need, say historic data, available publicly on the web? And how often are you having to make document requests for information?
It's actually quite unusual to find things publicly available. And when I do encounter, you know, a department in the government that's making things available, I'm always so impressed. You know, mm-hmm. I recently, you know, was talking to a local community group here, and this is similar. You know, I shouted out City Manager Barry Tippin, Reading City Manager, because Mr. Tippin is one of the people that, you know, when I reach out to him for a comment, he may not like my stories, he may not agree with my line of questioning, you know, that doesn't enter into it for him. He's a professional and he mm-hmm. answers my emails. And I really appreciate that because I think it really serves the public. Mm-hmm. It helps the public to get what they need. I see movement towards that with documents a little bit, you know, during this recent city riverfront process where they were deciding whether to sell riverfront land to a consortium of developers and nonprofits, they did, you know, some engagement work, and they included some of the surveys and survey responses and emails up on a website. That's good, but, you know, it's complicated because, like, that data, you know, it was too much for individuals to wade through. So what we did at Shasta Scout was we took that publicly available information, we did data analysis on it, and then we did an article showing this is what the data actually says. So, you know, the government has kind of a big task. I think a lot of times they put their focus toward, you know, all kinds of departments in the government put their focus towards, like, presenting information, like, in a kind of a good way, you know, being media spokespeople, that kind of thing. And I think more attention and more time and more resources could be given towards just providing the source documents and providing data analysis of them so that people have access to them and can make their own decisions. Sometimes we don't really need, like, the shiny, glossy version. We just want to know what's behind it and be able to trust that. But I think government's working to trust the people, just like people are working to trust the government.
Yeah, and understanding what the data really says. Yeah, that's important. The you mentioned the document request, and I know that there's been some energy around the document request that can be used by certain groups to slow things down, as which has implications for people trying to request documents for purposes of informing the public. What's your experience been requesting data? Are there any costs involved? How long does it typically take?
Yeah, I think you're referencing, you know, some groups and movements have recently started using document requests as a way to kind of jam up the works with public processes. And that's really unfortunate because it does have a fallout effect for people like me. The county recently kind of added some fee structures to their document requests. And I think that's, you know, an effort to just slow down illegitimate requests, you know, the ones that they still have to answer, but maybe aren't really serving the public's good. And that's the whole purpose behind document requests, is to serve the public. When we request documents, we upload them onto our document cloud, and, you know, we censor out any sensitive information, and we make them available to the public. We link directly to our source documents. So when you hear about a lawsuit or a court ruling, you're going to find a link to that court ruling itself, not just our analysis of it. And that I think is important. But yeah, the same thing is true with media requests. You know, sometimes if anyone can pretend to be a journalist, you know, if anyone can name themselves a citizen's journalist, it does reduce the incentive of government officials to speak to journalists. And so it has really a profound effect on people's ability to access news eventually, you know, and I do see that. And I have sympathy for the government officials who are dealing with that.
Have you had to do anything in addition in order to respond to that situation in terms of credentials, or I'm not sure.
Yeah. Certainly, like with Health and Human Services, you know, there's been so much really attacks on public health over the last several years, that, you know, our local Health and Human Services agency really set up some pretty strict policy around what they would consider a media group. And I think that's reasonable. I think it's reasonable to say that there should be some qualifications to consider yourself, you know, a journalist with access to, you know, certain parts of government because you're a journalist. For us, you know, we're on a website, so sometimes because we're digital only, people can just think we're a blog or something. But, you know, we are members of something called the Institute for Nonprofit News, and becoming a member there requires their board to actually analyze and assess your policies and your policies around, you know, what code of ethics do your journalists subscribe to. So we subscribe to the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, which has a lot of detail to, you know, how we can treat our sources, how we can tell our stories, you know, that we can't target people, that we can't use, like, name calling and things like that, you know. And they also look at, like, our transparency, like, do we share who we're funded by, you know, when we get large donations, and Do we have correction policies? Things like that. So there really is a higher standard that news can be held to, and we're making sure that we're putting ourselves in a position to be held to that higher standard. So definitely one of the big stories that we have covered a few times and would like to continue to cover are deaths in the county jail, specifically a young man named John Adina, who died in the jail under somewhat mysterious or unusual circumstances. Essentially, you know, what our investigation showed and what his family's lawsuit alleges is that, you know, the cause of death as indicated on the autopsy doesn't really match the mechanism of injury that's documented on the autopsy. And I'm saying this as a journalist, you know, not a legal expert, but there's some pretty concerning indications there. And, you know, of course we care about this young man, you know, we also care about any kinds of patterns we're seeing and how his death might connect to other deaths. There is another, you know, series of records we've looked at from someone who died just a few weeks before him, also under a sort of unusual circumstances in the jail. And there have been many other deaths there. So when we look at one of those stories, you know, we're continually looking for the patterns. You know, what can we see that could show not just how this particular death might have been able to be prevented or what caused it, but also how could we, you know, avoid future deaths in the jail? So that's definitely one of them. Another, you know, issue we've looked at is any kinds of connections between law enforcement and local members of an unofficial militia here. That kind of started because militia members, you know, told me when I was reporting on the ground during Black Lives Matter protests that they had been asked to be there by the sheriff. That's unsubstantiated by the sheriff. You know, he has not confirmed that. But of course, it matters a great deal to know, you know, where those connections are happening and who, you know, if indeed private citizens are being asked to, you know, participate in law enforcement activities, that would be really, really important to find out. So we're always kind of looking for documentation related to those kinds of things. Also, like military equipment that law enforcement brings on, that's been another thing that we've looked at because, well, a lot of people just feel like, well, why not give them all the equipment they need? A lot of military equipment as used by law enforcement can be kind of a challenge to our civil rights, you know, particularly use of drones, things like that. You know, it might sound good in theory until we're the ones being watched. And so, you know, our job as journalists is always to think about who might be watched and why might that matter to their civil rights. So that's another area where we've definitely been looking. And you know, I'd very much like to look into the use of canines as well by law enforcement. This is another place where, you know, canines are dogs, right? People love dogs. Dogs are cute. You know, people tend to be really into police canines. But the truth is, they can do really destructive, terrible things to human bodies. And they're trained to do that. They're deployed to do that. And so we need to be looking carefully as watchdogs at when are they being deployed, under what circumstances, who allows that, what kind of injuries are they inflicting? Does the punishment fit the crime, essentially? You know, these are people who might be searched out by a dog for something relatively minor. It's possible, you know, I'm not commenting on any specific case, but, you know, if that person represents a real threat to the public, then a dog might be the right solution, you know. But if they don't, then we have to ask ourselves, you know, what kind of injury to a human body is worth it? So those are the kinds of things that we're always thinking about and looking to look into.
Yeah, so I hear in what you're saying, just checking in with you, that role of accountability, drawing, seeing if there are patterns, what they might mean, bringing that to the attention of whatever organization, hearing from them, entering ideally into a dialogue because these are issues that are important to the public at large to know about.
Yeah, and I mean, another, you know, key area is how law enforcement interacts with our unsheltered community, you know, people living on the streets. And I think it's important to remember, you know, police are put in such difficult roles. And so there's a lot of pressure from our local community, from business owners and from city officials for the police to crack down on homelessness. what does that mean on the streets? You know, especially if we don't have enough resources, especially if we don't have enough access to emergency housing, we're kind of putting our local law enforcement staff, you know, between a rock and a hard place. So what could happen in that situation? Could be the things that are happening that shouldn't be happening, you know? And so that's where we can actually serve law enforcement too, you know, by looking at, okay, why are these things happening? Maybe because we don't have the resources we need. That in the end really serves law enforcement, even though in the short run it might look like targeting them or, you know, being tough on them. But, you know, in the long run, it helps them do their jobs and it helps them feel supported.
Other stories that you're following that you think are really important for the public to be aware of?
I definitely think, you know, we've spent a lot of time on sort of land development and land use. And I have to say, when I started reporting these stories, I thought this was just so boring. You know, I kind of got into journalism to do really cool stuff, you know, and here I am reporting on general plans and, you know, planning commissions. It just seems like the kind of thing old people read. But, you know, it turns out it's really central to how you develop a community, you know, figuring out who the voices should be at the table and really making sure that the community is considering all those voices turns out to be like a central driver of a local economy and has a lot to do with the environment. It has to do with wildfire and water and so many things, you know. So we are watching very closely land development and land use, and that's one of our priorities. We're also very focused on housing because, again, housing can seem dry, but it affects each and every one of us, and it affects crime, it affects homelessness, it affects our jobs, because if people can't afford the housing that, you know, matches the kind of job they have, you know, that they can afford, then they won't come for those jobs, you know, which can affect our labor market and our businesses. So things like housing that can come across as boring, you know, part of my job as a journalist is try to make that interesting for people, try to help them understand, you know, how does eviction court work? What is it like to be evicted? Who's getting evicted in Reading? Those are some of the things that, you know, I really want to be able to bring people inside those spaces. That's what's fun about journalism, is when you can be in a room and you can use your words to bring people into the room with you and they can really experience it. And we want to tell more of those stories so that people feel invested in issues that might have otherwise seemed boring.
Yeah, and I can see in your passion too that the importance of helping people understand how those are connected. What are the systemic issues behind all of those? What unravels when affordable housing unravels?
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the great things about being a journalist is, you know, you get to start to understand that. You talk, you know, one source at a time, you talk to people, and more the pieces start to fit together. And I can never tell all the stories that are inside of my head, you know, from talking to all these people, but more and more I can start to put the puzzle pieces together to help people understand the community better. And really, that's what democracy building is about. It's about knowing where your power lies and where you need to work and then going to work there.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of power, as a sociologist, I've long been really interested in a number of the dynamics that we've spoken about. And one of them we haven't addressed too often on this show are gender dynamics. And you mentioned earlier being a woman journalist in a field that needs more both owners of production as well as journalists. So I'm wondering if you could talk to us about how gender dynamics has played out both in the work that you do and perhaps in some of the stories that you cover.
Yeah, I'm pretty passionate about this issue because I do think it makes a great deal of difference who's telling the story. And there are a lot of stories that when you tell them from, you know, your own lived experience, which in my case is, you know, as a female, when I'm telling those stories, I give a different voice to it and I bring different priorities to it. A lot of our culture is built around masculine priorities. It's just been that way for a long time. And a lot of times when we look at the dynamics of how things are working in our communities, there's a high value for, you know, assertiveness and, you know, taking charge and those kinds of things. As a woman, I'm always looking to develop Shasta Scout into a different kind of organization, collaborative, you know, very integrative, community-centric, you know, very open communication. And all of those things inform how we report as well. So when I'm talking to sources, you know, there's always a pro and a con to being a woman. You know, I think in many ways being a woman is disarming to a lot of my sources. If I'm speaking to, you know, Congressman Doug LaMalfa, he is going to feel probably less on guard with me than he might with, you know, a tough male reporter. On the other hand, sometimes I'm not treated professionally or respectfully because I'm a woman. So there's always that balance. I do have safety concerns. You know, that's something that I walk around with every day, that I have active threats, you know, that I have protocols in place to protect myself. There are places and spaces I go into where I'm afraid to go, and where, you know, I have my exit routes mapped out and I have somebody waiting on the other side of the phone line. So those things, being a woman, you know, you do feel more at risk, because sexual assault is one of the weapons that can be used against you and is much more frequently used against you as a woman. But also, you know, I feel really privileged to be able to tell stories from a woman's perspective and to be able to help bring more voices to the table, to tell more nuanced stories, to, you know, make it less about money and power, sometimes, and more about, you know, all the nuanced dynamics. So there's a lot of different ways that I think I storytell because of my gender. And I really like covering different stories. You know, just like I tell stories differently, the stories I choose to cover also are affected by my gender. Mm. You know, when the Sherry Papini story came out, and you know, the allegations that she had lied about being kidnapped, one of the first things that I saw online after those allegations was a lot of misogyny, you know, comments on Facebook basically saying, you know, I hope she goes to jail and I hope she gets raped there, you know, and that was so triggering to me, you know, as a woman who has experienced sexual assault. It, you know, for days I felt kind of on edge, that the idea that one woman's lying might somehow increase my risk as well, you know, in my community. Mm. And so the story that I ended up coming out with was a story about how often women tell the truth about sexual assault and why we should believe women, even if Sherry Papini did lie. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an example, you know, that's kind of a little bit of an extreme example, but it's an example of how, you know, every time I'm looking at a story, you know, right now I'm interviewing all the Reading City Council candidates, you know, and we have women and men. And I am taking note of the differences in work history of, you know, some of the women were stay-at-home moms for 10 or more years. You know, how do I share that in a way that honors and respects that role they chose for themselves, you know, in the way that our culture often expects them to choose that role, right alongside men who've never been asked to take on that role? You know, how do I make sure that there's some equity in the way that I talk about experience when our culture might not value that experience? So it just comes through all the time in all kinds of stories. I think it's a huge factor.
Mm. And have you noticed, or how have you noticed, gender dynamics play out when we look at women leaders in our community or some of those, whether it's candidate forums or how women are interviewed generally?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's really a kind of a double-edged sword. I think a lot of times, like in forums, you know, political forums, I notice a very misogynistic tone in some of these forums, and I notice the crowd cheering for what to me as an observer seems kind of like misogyny. You know, it seems like we're valuing aggression and dominance over policy. And that's concerning. You have to think, how can I help the audience understand this dynamic that if you're in the room is really apparent, but without leading them to that conclusion? You know, how can I not make that my opinion, but still be able to comment on it? Much of the time, I'm just not really able to draw it into the story because it's too much of a feeling and it's not really a fact I can point to. Mm. But I'll also say that, you know, covering like Reading City Council or other public meetings, I often do see too that even just in speaking to sources about decisions the council made, that a lot of sources, you know, male and female alike, will hold women to a higher standard of conduct than they do men. Women are more often accused of, you know, being disagreeable or unpleasant or disrespectful than men are. It seems like because we expect them to be more so at all times. And the same kind of thing, you know, with women rising into positions of power, there's the same kind of thing where there's a little bit of a discounting of their experience and their fitness for the job. You know, you really can feel that when you talk to sources. You know, you don't usually repeat those parts of the interview because they're not really central to what you're mm-hmm. telling your readers. But you can hear all those undercurrents, you know, how people are viewing people based on their gender and other factors like that. So, I think it does come into play quite a bit. And it's one of the things that we as journalists have to really weed through. And I actually think it's one of the things women are really well equipped to weed through because we've experienced it in our own lives. So that, again, coming back to equity, you know, part of why it matters to have women journalists and women in media is because we can tell the truth about what it's like to be a woman in public office or what it's like to be a woman on the streets. And, you know, as people who often, you know, many of us have had experiences with sexual assault, we can share those lived experiences that we have inform our reporting. They inform the voice we give. And I think, I think it's a gift to have that voice, but it's also a burden sometimes.
Mm. And I know people will often think, well, you do such a great job. You've created this organization, you're a writer, you're a journalist. People who are trying to find a way in to either have their story heard or to be part of the solution, what do you tell them about ways that they can get involved?
Yeah, I think, you know, what a lot of people don't know about my story is that, you know, I come from a very deeply religious, misogynistic past, and spent much of my life thinking that I was not qualified to work in the same jobs that men were because I was a woman. So, you know, one of the things that I like to tell people is just to continue to learn who they are and the truth about mm-hmm. who they are, you know, and seek out people who respect them. I am really so grateful for, you know, the mentors I've had in my life over the last few years who've helped me to kind of come into my own, to recognize what I'm capable of and that I'm allowed to excel, you know, that I'm allowed to run and I'm allowed to grab hold of power and become part of that. And I think, you know, of course everyone is, but sometimes the people that most need to hold power are the ones least likely to grab hold of it, you know? Mm. So sometimes it's also really just about opening a door and pulling out a chair at the table. You know, that's what we try to do through our Community Voices series. We try to turn to people and say, I see that you have a lived experience that I could learn from. I would love for you to write for us, and we'll do whatever we can to make it happen. And that's some of the most powerful work we do because those are the voices that I learn the most from.
Any last words?
Yeah, I would just say you guys can all subscribe for free. You know, you can put your email in and you'll get all our latest stories. And the biggest way you can help us right now is just to share those stories just so we gain a wider distribution, more circulation. That helps us enormously. So thanks.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Support.